trying to develop a kind of second dimension of our lives, where we're always aware, always aware. And that's not being self-obsessed. Self-obsession is self-obsession. It's not that. It's just becoming aware of something that's going on all the time. Self-obsession would be if I was just kind of totally worried about myself and trying to get this and trying to get that and critical, and that wouldn't really be awareness. So it's not self-obsession. And awareness practice is, in a broader sense, it's always in the context of a good lifestyle, a lifestyle which has altruism in it, which is ethically, morally very sound, which emphasizes a generosity, compassion, and so on and so forth. So sometimes a retreat, maybe people think we're very, very selfish doing this. But also it's not easy. I'm sure there's selfish things you could do which would be much easier. Go to Mexico or something. So it's quite a challenge to be sort of deliberately trapped in this situation to then observe what happens to you. And just that we are willing to do that builds the skill, strength, power of reflection in consciousness, no matter what the experience is. So when we leave this retreat, that skill of inner knowing will be stronger, won't it? Right? And so there are a lot of hidden things in a retreat which aren't, maybe the samadhi's not so smooth as you'd like it. Maybe the insights aren't popping up a dime a dozen. Your knees might hurt and so on. So fellows like me just try to keep encouraging you to keep going. This does have value. And it does. And that, so that when we do live our normal social lives, they are also lives of contemplation. So we have different social contexts we live within and work within. So I'm very much involved with my mother's care right now, and also with the OBS teaching. So that's my social aspect. But then within that is always the what we call the practice. And people say, how's your practice? And this is this kind of Buddhist thing. How's your practice? And then people say, oh, well, I wish you didn't ask that. So people sometimes think, when I ask that, they think, how long have you been sitting? Like the cop, right? The monk cop who checks out on the lay people. Did you do your half hour? Huh? And I really, so then I'm embarrassed when they're embarrassed and sort of back off. But really, practice is just this capacity for inner reflection, inner knowing, mindfulness of the way things are. Right? And it doesn't mean that you're always a goody good Buddhist, or that your meditation is, you're always on the mark and so on. Those are good things. Meditation is a very, very, like formal practice is very good, but this continual inner vigilance is really the key to a contemplative life and a key to understanding ourselves. So for me, I've been, I did some lovely canoe trips last summer. And the last one I did was in September. That was awesome, fabulous. But I came back and my mother was really bent over. She's already lost, I think, 5 inches. She's 5'4". She used to be 5'4". She's now under 5. She doesn't like that. And that's the osteoporosis. And it was kind of so bad that the doctors thought she'd broken her back. So she's really quite over, but I came back from this retreat, it was like a retreat for me, from this canoe trip, and she's almost like, parallel to the floor. And I had all kinds of teaching engagements I canceled. I had booked myself up to April doing some teaching every month, in Waterloo and Toronto and Peterborough. But I thought, no, I better not do that. So I better watch her over the winter. Then kind of really was afraid she'd get really depressed. That really kind of shocked me. But what also was surprising that within, when I got back home, within 2 or 3 hours, she was up again. That was amazing. You know, that she was so much kind of in her own situation, on her own. She wasn't acting or anything, that she was just burdened by her own predicament. And just, you know, just having human contact for this little period of time. I mean, she still got her home, but she was sort of there again. So that was a kind of powerful insight into mind-body, you know, the relationship of mind-body. And so it's been 6 months of caregiving, which has been interesting. And I did, I allowed myself those teaching engagements to just get a change. And I enjoy teaching, so this is good fun for me. And it gives me a chance to express Dhamma and rather than watch Larry King, which is not very expressive. But so, okay, so that's the sort of situation where I then learn from. And are these challenges bad? I don't think so, because that's really what makes me grow. It's always kind of being in situations where I just have to learn how to be mindful here. I have to stretch my capacities to. So, lots of cabin fever this winter. Kind of, I go for long walks. That's not a problem. You know, I think of Jarvis. Sure, it's Mickey Mouse, isn't it? So that's a good reflection. You know, kind of to think, well, it's nothing to what people have to experience. And yet not to be dismissive. I think this is important to see that, okay, if I feel cabin fever, it's still cabin fever. I can say, well, someone can say, it's not as bad as Jarvis. Yeah, but it's still cabin fever. So not to be dismissive, but also not to be melodramatic, I suppose. It's to find, okay, this is restlessness. This is kind of whatever it is. Have I got enough mindfulness to be with this now? So the idea of mindfulness, it just gets bigger and bigger, where nothing can, it's like a big container where nothing can fool it. And this requires a tremendous amount of first of all, I think it requires that the love of a challenge, right? It requires enough space where you can take the challenge on. So sometimes life's stresses and responsibilities are just too much for people and they break down. So just to take some kind of Buddhist position that all stress is good for you is not true. It's not true. And people ask me, well, how much is good? Beats me. Do you have a choice? So in the text, they talk about the perfect places of practice. We have, I think, what, 13 points which describe the perfect monastery and all of that. And so then, you know, I've seen monks that kind of go through the 13 points and they find, no, I've only got 12 here. I can't practice. Yeah, Jack, I know. We used to call that the Jack system. It's the monk who came along and said, it's not good enough, and would leave. He says, I got mine, Jack, I'm out of here. Whereas Ajahn Chah, when we went to England, we ended up in this very busy place in London, and he said, oh, it's good practice here. They insult you. He and Ajahn Sumedho had been on alms round, and some skinhead had threatened them. And Ajahn said, oh, yeah, you can stay in England, it's good for you. It was noisy, it was smelly, it was... people came in and ripped the Dana box off the wall and walked out with it. Kind of drunks coming in during the meditation. There's all kinds of... So what's the practice? So what I really loved about the way Ajahn Chah taught and then Ajahn Sumedho subsequently was just like to keep the mind very open. Don't look at practice as some formal posture or some little technique that you manipulate the mind with, but something much grander, life. Just whatever's there. But the complexities of life can certainly be overwhelming. So there is a great emphasis on simplicity. So one can aim towards a good social situation. That's quite valid. We're always doing that. But the idea of like social dharma and then inner reflection is a very important idea. So let's say reading that letter, I felt the sense of in righteous indignation arising in my mind, and I could proliferate on that and get angry. But if I'm really contemplating stream of consciousness, what good is that going to do? Is that going to be good for myself, or the peace of myself, or others? No, it's not going to be good. So then I abandon righteous indignation, because it's not skillful. So we have the word acceptance, and people sometimes think that Buddhism is a sort of kind of doormat philosophy where people can wipe their Reeboks on your face and may you be happy kind of philosophy. But it's not that. There is a social philosophy, there is social activism, but it's done within the context of understanding the mind. Right? So if I make my social activism primary and the understanding of the inner world secondary, I'm toast. Because then I start to justify my righteous indignation. So let's say I'm not reflecting and taking responsibility for my inner world, and I read that letter, and I start to get off on righteous indignation. People love that, don't they? They love to be angry. Look at all the anger in the world about cartoons, and people really enjoying anger. Yeah, I hate this and I hate that. And whereas if you're really taking responsibility for your own mind, then even though another person say you are justified in being angry, it's still anger. It's still a defilement. It still closes the heart. It's still a cause of suffering myself and others. So then one's work in the world is imbued with inner responsibility, inner vigilance, but still outward action. So one still does the best one can do in an ethical way. One still writes letters. One still lobbies. One still speaks out against injustice or whatever, you know, whatever situation you're in. But the primary thing is the heart. The primary thing is the heart, because that will be your guide, right? That will be your guide. If you do it the other way around, it can't possibly work. Green peace. Green but not peaceful sometimes. Or this kind of animal liberation nutties in England now. They go burning laboratories and threatening to kill university professors. And it's kind of nutty people with their kind of righteous indignation. And it's a very destructive energy. You know, I am right and you are wrong. Whereas when you are coming from the heart, literally, when you see injustice, you can call injustice. You can say that's not right. That's totally wrong. But it doesn't come from ego. It doesn't come from anger. It doesn't come from all those kind of warped energies. So on this retreat, we're not talking about social activism. We're not talking about social issues. I'm not very educated in those. You probably know much more about those things than me. What we're cultivating now is this capacity for inner reflection. So acceptance is not condolence. You know, when we use the word in this chant that we've been doing in the morning, we talk about kindness, compassion, appreciation or gladness, and equanimity. Now, equanimity is the state of acceptance. It's the state of peacefulness. And when people read that, they sometimes misinterpret that to mean a kind of condoning of cruelty or a kind of passive fatalism. Oh, it's my karma. I just accept things. But it's not that. It's just that I think we can only really understand ourselves and act in the world when we accept the way things are. And yet, on a social sense, I can say this is unacceptable. You can have both. So when I'm trying to understand how consciousness works, it's just stream of consciousness. So I have to just say, what is it like now? And to understand that, I have to accept it, right? If I already have prejudged it, that, you know, I shouldn't feel angry, and this is wrong and that's wrong, I just create some kind of inadequate self. I'm inadequate, I'm not up to the mark, I'm not good enough. And then I start do things to myself and to my mind to become adequate. But that, you won't get any insight that way. You just get bruised. So to just like, to, I mean, we're all trying to be better people, but to come from the position that I am bad and I am wrong and there's something kind of, I shouldn't be angry and I shouldn't be fearful, and then approach the mind from that pre-judgment, I won't be mindful. I'll just be trying to get rid of all the things I shouldn't be. And it's not mindfulness, right? Having no perspective, well, it's just my karma to hit people in the face. It's just my karma to drink whiskey, and it's just this is the way I am. It's nature. That's also annoyed, obviously. So there is a sense of wanting to work on anger, wanting to work on fear, wanting to work on whatever things that I work on, but not from the self position, but more just this is stream of consciousness. There are these kinds of habits and energies which cause myself suffering and others suffering, and how do they work? And what would be the way of awakening to them? And what would be the way of not getting caught by them? Now that's not from the self position. You know, it still is individual, but it's not like I am bad and I have to get good somewhere in the future. You see what I mean? See the difference? And that's what we quite often do, because we are good people. And we are aspiring to Nibbana or whatever, you know, whatever our, we define our aspiration. And we have very wholesome intentions, otherwise we wouldn't be here. And then we idealize, maybe, what we should be. And then we judge ourselves as being wrong, and then we approach meditation from this, what we call self-view, wrong view, or wrong understanding. So the entry point into true transformation, true liberation, comes about when we see this is just suffering, this is anger, this is fear, this is doubt, this is worry, whatever it is. And rather than, I'm a bad person for being angry, I've got too much anger, I've got an anger problem, I have to work on my anger. You see the difference? And it's very important. Because otherwise I'll never accept the way things are, I'll never let them reveal themselves, and I'll always just be fighting with my inner world. I might do kind of sort of things that make me feel good for a while, but I'll never really liberate the heart. So the when we talk about right understanding, that's a very, very important, in the Pali we call it Sakaya Ditti, personality view. So there's individuality, certainly, and my stream of the stream of consciousness I'm experiencing is different than yours, right? But to say witness to that, that's the same. We're all aware, we're all witnessing to it. And we're trying to just see thought is thought, emotion is emotion, feeling is feeling, memory is memory. These things just as dharmas, just as the dharmas of, you know, whatever way they manifest. That's the beginning of the practice. So if your inner voices are very kind of me, my voices, then just see, oh, that's self-view. That's self-perception. Come back to the knowing. Yeah? Keep listening. You listen to the mind. If it's voices any voice of self, I've got it. I've really sussed it this time, this retreat. Be careful. That's just a voice. That's just a perception. I am someone who has sussed it. That's just a perception. Let it die. Let it go back to knowing. Then the other perception come up, what a useless retreat. I mean, I didn't even see my nose. It's just absolutely basket case. That's another perception. Just let it go. So perception cease. If you don't do that, what happens? Either I grab the perception, I have sussed it, and you can't keep that one going, can you? Because inevitably you feel a lack of confidence. And then you crash. And you cry, oh, my practice is down the tube. I'm hopeless. It was a useless retreat. I'll never, you know. And that's just another self-view, and another self-view, and another self-view. But that which knows the self-view is not a viewpoint. It's not a position. I'm not taking a position that I am great or that I'm useless. I'm just knowing these are positions that come and go. There are perceptions that come and go. So the knowing of self-perceptions, self-definitions, has a worldly validity. So, and this is where we when we talk about the worldly dharmas, I can say that I have certain skills. You know, I can do things well in one area, and then other areas I'm not so skilled, I'm not so good at it. Najan Kuslo, he's very skilled in some things that I'm not skilled in, and vice versa. And that's a valid way of talking, and it's true. But the personality view would come up when I start to compare myself with Ajahn Kuslo, and I, you know, like he's a really good craftsman, and he's got a really good chance, and I start to feel inferior, oh, I can't do that, I'm not that good. That self-view, all that kind of suffering that we have from comparison. So on one hand, it's true. Like in Thai, they say, jing de mai tuk, tuk de mai jing. It's right, but it's not true. It's true, but it's not right. So on the social level, there are differences. There are skills. There are people who are better. But as a ego position, as a self-view, it's disastrous. So you notice that the knowing isn't a position. It's not a viewpoint. It's not a self. It's consciousness knowing the way things are. It's not blank. It's not vacant. It's just this mystery. This mystery of consciousness. This is the way it is now. And that is what we are trying to remember to come home to. And I've been using that language a little bit. Just like, do you have a sense of that in your practice, in your heart? Is there something that you attune to that reminds you of home? It's very helpful. Say Ajahn Sumedho, like he likes to use the sound of silence. So when you do the listening, maybe now that your mind is starting to get quiet, when you open to listening and you really let go, and you're not trying to get anything, your mind, your consciousness becomes very expansive and you start to hear a sound. Maybe you notice that, a kind of background zinging sound. And Ajahn Sumedho uses that a lot for his sort of home ground. So you can relax into that. I like to use the heart or just a sense of knowing. This is home. And that is something that's, you know, awareness is just consciousness. It's just like being. It's always there. So in terms of right understanding, what happens is that the mistake that is made is that we identify ourselves with the changing things, with our emotions, with the bodily feelings, with memories, and then those self-perceptions we believe, and the mind gets our consciousness gets very confused by all that. And in a stroke, you can jump out of that. Just in a stroke, you can just see. You can have the most difficult meditation, and you can really start to beat yourself up, and then you just know, oh, that's just perception. And it ceases, and your mind is home again. You're home again. You've reminded yourself of home. And the more you do that, the more that becomes the default. And that's what you want the default to be. You want the default to be freedom, don't you? The habitual default is quite often to negative things like self-disparagement or complaining or anxiety. And this is the unskilled mind, the untrained mind. Its default mechanisms are neurotic. Right? We're all suffering from those kinds of things. And it's not that we just want to kind of we don't want to just reprogram it into another kind of personality. It's like a personality A as opposed to personality B. We just want to get beyond personality. So it's not so much becoming better as letting go of the whole sense of self-identity. And then what's left is just this conscious experience of movement, of change. I always ask, what do you trust in? Where's your faith? And then people think I'm kind of laying a Buddhist trip on them. Well, I don't know about Buddhism and meditation, that's all right, but I don't want to be... I'm not talking about dogma, but what is really faith? What do you trust in when the chips are down? Where's your default mechanism? Do you trust in worry? Do you trust in distraction? Where do you go? When life gets difficult, where do you go? The Buddha's recommendation is to trust in awareness. In listening. And that's very, very simple, but quite often we don't trust it. Because we've been we've been conditioned to like analyze a lot, figure things out, get rid of them. And we're up against some pretty insidious habits. So even though we might kind of agree with this, or we might understand it, we're up against pretty strong habits. So we, in meditation, we're cultivating ways of remembering. Because that's the problem, isn't it? We just forget. We just kind of lose the plot, don't we? We know. We've seen the awake mind. We've been there. And then, you know, life takes over and we get all caught up. So ways of remembering isn't the same as just trying to get rid of stuff and become someone different. It's different. It's not. It's a different, whole different way of approach. I'm not trying to become someone different, but I'm awakening to the way things are. Now, the wonderful thing about that is that very way of functioning brings the heart to the present moment and actually opens us up to a whole different way of a whole different possibility. This is the magic of it, is that when we let go of becoming, when we let go of this sort of endless effort of trying to be better people, and we just stop and open up to the way things are and have the patience just to witness, then in that witnessing we begin to see that there's a tremendous kind of integrity and peacefulness in consciousness. And we miss that. The reason we miss that is because we're always sort of out trying to do something, get rid of something, and distracting and busy and that. And we miss that which is always there, that kind of home ground. I suggested trying just noticing the resistance to pain. Things like that. So when we are habituated to always seeking the pleasant and getting rid of the unpleasant, we get so restless that we never learn how to stop. It's just kind of this kind of wheel, like a mouse in one of those squirrely cages, just going around and around and around. And a retreat is like in your face stopping, isn't it? It's like hit the brick wall. And then what comes up is all the habits of mind, the restlessness and some peace, hopefully. Hopefully the mind's a bit more peaceful, but often it's just the kind of momentum of becoming. And now I think what's really important at this stage of the game and at all stages of the game is just to say, this is the way it is now. Just trust that. This is the way it is now. It feels this way now. Keep coming home, and see what happens. See what happens when you put your faith in awareness rather than becoming. So don't try to become a better person. Keep the precepts. So the precepts are very important and the structures are very important because they are what contain the unskillful energies. So we have this really strong container, and within that, just I suggest, just develop trust in this, the way it is now. Let go of becoming. Let go of the need to always figure out and analyze and understand, even let go of that, the desire to understand. Let go of all desire, come to desirelessness and see what happens, and see how difficult it is. It's quite profound, this desirelessness, this is the way it is now. And just putting up that kind of language, I find, wow, look at that restlessness. That mind always wanting to do something, get somewhere, figure something out. It's very powerful. The energy of birth is very powerful in consciousness. So contrasting that and bringing up this very radical and challenging language of desirelessness, nothing to do, nothing to become, not as a position, not as an ego position, but as a kind of reflective tool, like a mirror. And you do that, you bring up like nowhere to go, just be. And then you see the mind, which is always trying to become and do something and get rid of something and organize something and figure it out, is the restlessness of the mind. As just listening to a tape of Ajahn Sumedho's on a retreat he did at Spirit Rock, and he's a very, very accomplished meditator. And he was talking about the last of the 10 fetters, and so it's just an incredible amount of restlessness coming up in consciousness. There's a man that's been at it pretty solid for many, many, many years, and very accomplished, and just the energy of becoming, the energy of birth just kind of coming up into consciousness. You wouldn't know it, he's such a calm and jolly person. And so realize that we are involved with powerful energies, and we're kind of going against the force of nature in some ways, aren't we? The force of becoming, all of that, and so it's quite a challenge. Why do that? Well, because one realizes that in the conditioned realm there's no refuge. I mean, that has to be, I think, there has to be a pretty fundamental sense of that in that which changes, you cannot find spiritual peace. No condition can satisfy, no condition can liberate. There has to be that sense of renunciation, that sense of, well, it can't be a sound, it can't be a sight, it can't be an emotion, what's left? This awareness. And if you have that faith in that, then it is possible to sit through, like, restlessness. Oh, it's just this restlessness. It's all right. I'll just be rest. Just let it be there however long it wants to be there. That's non-desire. Desire is, now what kind of practice can I do to get rid of restlessness? Okay, if I'm going to do this and I do that. No, but then you can do it for a while. You can control yourself and it falls apart. So in the work with the breath or work with the heart, and you feel one of the hindrances coming up, and, oh, this is just the way it is. Keep staying present with it, but give it a chance just to flower. Let it be what it is, the anger or the fear. Don't. It's saying something. Let it say something. So you're the perfect host, right? Fine, you can stay. Have a whiskey. Perfect host just lets all things come in and go out. And that's hard to do. Very hard to do, because we're so conditioned to whack the door in the face of some of these guys. So these are like attitudes, they're not techniques. So I've suggested, a lot of body work, right? A lot of that, because I find that helpful. But deeper than the technique, deeper than some neat little technique that one learns, is an attitude of staying home, where is home, an attitude of being able to endure the movement of pleasant and unpleasant, an attitude of being willing to witness the difficult things. These are deeper than any technique. And so right understanding, I think fundamentally, is that awareness is really where it's at, not the condition. So whatever condition comes up, Can I deepen my awareness with it? Rather than if I had another condition, then I could meditate. So if you're feeling sleepy and dull, certainly that's a nuisance, isn't it? Like if you're sleepy now on day three, that's depressing. you pay all this money. You come all this way. And that damn thing is sleepy, right? So, yeah, it is. Yeah, it's a nuisance. But the challenge is, okay, how can I sustain awareness through sleepiness? And it's hard. So then there's the aversion to the sleepiness and all the rest of it. But that's the challenge. That's what you've got. Or your mind starts throwing up Bob Dylan songs or plans, things, whatever. Okay, that's what I'm trying to be aware of. Or some incredible grief comes up into the mind. Oh, no, not now. But what, well, when? When am I going to learn about it? So, okay, this is what I have to be aware with, right? So the condition is always trying to bamboozle you. But awareness knows this is something that it arises, hangs in for a while, stays, and then ceases. And that's the challenge. It's a challenge of awareness rather than a challenge of kind of getting what you want. All right, so I'll leave that for reflection.
Dhammayang dhammavargata sadhukaraṁ dhammase sadhu 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 anumodami.
There's just a question on